So it's really important to support women-owned businesses because of the disadvantage that many are at. And then in terms of 1% for the planet, yes, we are a proud member of 1% for the planet, meaning that we donate, and I don't like to say donate, we invest 1% of our sales in environmental causes and organizations. And not only that, we go a step further, in addition to investing 1% of our sales in environmental organizations, we actually volunteer monthly with an organization called Food Rescue US.
Welcome to the Brands for a Better World podcast, the podcast that brings you the stories behind people and products building a more just, healthy, and regenerative future for us all. Tune in weekly, and together, we'll learn why these better products and brands were created, how they're helping fix broken systems, and what you can do to support them. My hope is that you'll discover some new brands to love and get some sparks of inspiration that will help you live your best life. Hi, I'm your host, Gage Mitchell, founder of Modern Species, a sustainable brand design agency helping better brands grow to scale their impact. This podcast is one way we do that. If you like the show, please help it grow by leaving ratings and reviews on your podcast app and by sharing your favorite episodes with your friends. Maybe this will be one of them. On this episode, I'm speaking with Kimberly Lau, founder and plant-based baking mama at Bake Me Healthy, about her start in skincare, the food intolerances that pushed her towards launching a plant-based, gluten-free, and allergen-free baking business, why her products are better for people and the planet, and what she's learned in her first 3 years as an entrepreneur. We then wrap up with a fun rapid round question segment. Enjoy.
Hi, I'm Kimberly Lau. I'm the founder of Bake Me Healthy. We are the first top 9 allergen-free upcycled baking company that delivers joy in every delicious bite.
Awesome. I'm excited to have you on the show. I've been following your progress with Bake Me Healthy for a little while now. I can't remember when we started talking, but I want to say at least a year ago, maybe a couple of years ago. I'm not sure yet, or I'm not sure I didn't look back in the history, but I'm excited to hear more about how it's going now because I've been kind of following around on social media and in communities and stuff that we're participating in, but I haven't gotten a chance recently to just dig in and hear what's going on. So first off, when I was poking around in your background a little bit more, I noticed that you had a pretty long and successful career in skincare. And I could easily imagine if you had entrepreneurial spirit that you could have launched your own brand in that space if you wanted. But instead, you pivoted into food. So I'm curious why. Can you talk about how that journey came about?
Sure. So yes, I spent pretty much my entire career in beauty, leading product innovation and marketing for beauty companies. Remember, everyone from Laura Mercier, Philosophy, Sundial, and Shea Moisture. And I loved ingredients. That's why I stayed in skincare for so long. I still love skincare. It's just the, you know, search for the fountain of youth. It was always exciting. And discovering novel ingredients was also so really enriching. And I love innovation. But at the same time, in addition to my passion for skincare, I've always had a passion for baking. I've baked for, gosh, as long as I can remember. And when I actually had kids about almost 13 years ago, I became a healthy baker because, like many moms, I wanted to nourish my kids with just wholesome ingredients. And certainly when they went to birthday parties, what I saw was just like overly sugary sweets and treats. And so I wanted to veer away from that. And so I started to bake healthier for them. At the same time, coming out of my pregnancy, I actually developed a number of food intolerances. And so from the pregnancy, it's amazing what pregnancy can do to your body in so many different ways. I had become lactose and egg intolerant. And so I had to alter my diet to accommodate these food restrictions, in also not only in the cooking, but also baking. So then pivoted the healthy baking towards more of a plant-based baking for those reasons. And then in 2020, I actually had a health scare when I became high risk for breast cancer. The doctors had discovered some atypical breast cells, and so I had them surgically removed, and I forever became high risk for breast cancer. And so my oncologist advised eliminating soy from my diet, And so again, I had to alter the diet for both cooking and baking to remove soy, which is no easy feat being Chinese American. But, you know, along the way, I discovered, you know, I've always loved skincare, I've always loved ingredients, but what I saw was an opportunity was to create something that would make baking inclusive. And so being able to enjoy and indulge in a brownie or a, you know, waffle without fear of what it will do to your body. And so that's why I launched Bake Me Healthy, was that so everyone could indulge and everyone can feel that they can enjoy a treat without fear of like either a food allergy or, you know, too much sugar or really just looking for wholesome ingredients. So I created it as a mom, but it was created for everyone.
That's cool. So did you have any sadness about leaving skincare, or was the excitement of moving into like food with your career just enough to let you walk away from skincare? Okay.
It's a good question. I didn't have any real sadness leaving beauty. I love beauty. I will always love beauty. It's where I spent almost 20 years. But the lure of going into food and better for you food and, you know, was certainly really exciting. And like I said, I like to say my love language is innovation. Taking that love language and applying it to food is super exciting.
Well, in which case, I'm super curious what your innovation process was like for Bake Me Healthy, because like you said, you've always been a baker and you slowly but surely over the past however many years have been transitioning to healthier baking, and then through a few life instances kind of switched to plant-based and then started removing other kind of allergens or other kind of things like soy. So that was a process of its own where you were probably not thinking about food products at that time. You were just thinking about making stuff for yourself. So that's a sort of a process of innovation and figuring out it on your own, right? But creating then food products for others, that's a whole different animal, I imagine. What was that process like? Like the difference between creating food for yourself versus transitioning to thinking about building a brand for inclusive baking?
So I actually started in 2020 with like a home bakery where I was baking for local clients because I enjoyed baking. And so I figured, let me start trying to bake some custom cupcakes and cakes for local clients. Of course, I started this in February of 2020, so weeks before the pandemic hit. And unfortunately, during the pandemic, there were not so many celebrations. But along the way, I like learned to figure out what consumers were looking for. But then when I decided to launch a mix to make it easy for folks at home to do their own baking, I actually outreached to Drexel University. So Drexel has an incubator lab called Drexel Food Labs, and I knew the director of Drexel Food Labs as he was a mentor to me. And so I partnered with them because I was like, I can make you a wedding cake, I can make you a birthday cake, anniversary cupcakes, but I was like, I didn't know how to create a mix, and not just a plain mix, but a mix that was free of the top 9 allergens. Sustainability is such a core value of mine. So I wanted to use upcycle ingredients, and the director had lots of connections to upcycled companies. And so I was like, let me lean in on them. And so I partnered with their team of food scientist students to actually develop the mixes. And so I was there at Drexel, which is in Philadelphia. I'm based here in Long Island, and I would go out there like weekly to do test development.
So was it them that brought up the idea of weaving in upcycled ingredients, or were you aware of that movement already and they just happened to have expertise and could help you?
I was aware of it through them, through the director initially. And so then it was just solidified in working with them.
Awesome. And we did do an episode. I wasn't prepared with the number of the episodes. So any listeners out there who want to go back and listen to the episode on the Drexel Food Lab, you can probably Google Drexel and Evolve CPG to go find that episode in our archive. And we'll have the link in the show notes too, in case you want to learn a little bit more about what they do. But yeah, I love that they're big advocates for upcycling, and they're such a great resource as well for kind of the bringing a culinary perspective to food science and product development. So that's cool that you, I guess I didn't realize that connection, or maybe I knew it and forgot it, that you had worked with them.
Yeah, it was great. It was a great program, and we, you know, not only had them help develop the mixes, but they also helped host focus groups and surveys and just really understanding more about what the consumer needs are.
So they helped kind of help you figure out how to take some of your ideas and turn it into a mix, of course, like you mentioned, and then check all these boxes that you were wanting to check. From that standpoint, did you then on your own say, okay, great, now I'm going to create all these different versions that I want to create with that knowledge that they gave you? Or did they help you develop all the products in your line?
So they did help me develop all the products in the current line. So we have four products in the lineup, and all of them were in collaboration with the Drexel Food Labs team.
Very cool. That must have been a fun process. And was it for those products? And, you know, let's all go ahead and talk about specifically what mixes you have too, to get people's mouths watering at home as they're listening. But were they each of those products your idea, or did they kind of help you through some of that consumer research, figure out which mixes you should make?
So we did consumer research in terms of surveys and focus groups to figure out what product flavors consumers are looking for from a mix. And all of them came from the survey with the exception of our dark chocolate fudgy brownie mix. And so as we were going into development, I was like, gosh, we really need a brownie mix. It's just people love brownies. People love chocolate. And so I suggested it to them, and it actually has become our number one bestseller.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And every time I go out and do store sampling or events, people are always like, let me try the brownie, because I think we just all have a sweet tooth for brownies. So the other mixes that they helped create was an oatmeal pancake and waffle mix, a banana bread mix, and a carrot cake and cupcakes mix.
Okay. And you said the brownie is the bestseller, but is that like by far, or do they all sell pretty well? Are they all fairly popular?
The brownie is definitely the hands down bestseller by far, followed by our oatmeal pancake and waffle mix.
Cool. And I know you already kind of alluded to it through the kind of needs that you were trying to check off and some of the product innovation around what you wanted these products to be. But after you got through all this and launched your brand, it seems you really dialed in on your pillars of plant-based, upcycled, allergen-free, and I think gluten-free as well. Is that correct?
Correct. So the mixes are gluten-free, they're vegan, nut-free, they're free of the top 9 allergens so that everyone can indulge.
Okay. And for those who, I'm assuming everyone with kids really understands the top 9 allergens, because it's probably a lot of restrictions around school lunches and stuff right now. But for those who aren't as familiar, do you know all the top 9 that you can list off?
Yeah. No, it's a great question. I often actually poll my community on social in terms of do people know what the top 9 allergens mean? And so the top 9 allergens are wheat, soy, sesame, tree nuts, peanuts, crustacean fish, shellfish, eggs, and dairy. I might have doubled one of those, but I think that those are the top 9.
Yeah. I always find it funny that peanuts are always kind of like listed as a separate thing. And I know they were kind of a differently grown, they're not naturally occurring nut, right? It was like a kind of hybrid, different kind of nut altogether. But I always imagine people being confused when they hear tree nuts and peanuts, because they're like, why is a peanut different? But then, yeah, maybe crustacean fish and shellfish, maybe they're in one category. I'm not sure.
Right. I don't know why they're broken out into those two.
But that's great. So anyone who has any one of those particular intolerances or allergies can enjoy your products. And then, as you mentioned, kind of the vegan plant-based angle too. So anyone avoiding animal products can also enjoy them. And then for upcycled kind of people wanting to help fight against food waste, that's another reason to support your products too, is because you use upcycled ingredients. But can you talk a little bit more about the upcycled ingredients? Like, which ingredients are upcycled and where do you get them from?
Sure. So we use a variety of upcycled ingredients across all our mixes. In each one of the mix, we use sunflower protein flour. And so that is upcycled from the leftover sunflower pulp from sunflower oil production. And so that's in all the mixes. It's protein rich. It's in our oatmeal pancake and waffle mix. Each serving provides 8 grams of plant protein. So it's a nice hearty protein flour. Then in our dark chocolate fudgy brownie mix, we use upcycled coffee cherry flour. So for those who are not familiar with coffee cherries, coffee beans actually grow in a fruit called coffee cherries. And those coffee cherries are thrown away every year. There's 4 billion tons of coffee cherries that are thrown away. And so we work with a company called Coffee Cherry Company to source their upcycled coffee cherry flour. And it actually enhances the flavor of the cocoa because coffee and cocoa are like cousins. And so it not only is it fighting food waste, but it's actually enhancing the flavor. And then in our banana bread mix, we include the ugly bananas. There's actually 6 billion bananas that are thrown away every year. Only grade A bananas make it to your supermarket. Grades B through D often make it to maybe a lower grade supermarket or are thrown away. And then in our carrot cake mix, we use ugly carrots. These are upcycled from a company called Outcast Foods. And you can think of those ugly carrots that like have the feet that like or like look like they're intertwined or just like misshapen. And carrots are actually the number one produce discarded on farms every year.
Wow, I didn't know that. Is that just because they grow in all sorts of funky ways or they're not like the right length or something like that?
Right.
Because we've all seen those funny pictures of carrots that kind of like split and look like legs or other kind of weird things like that. So I imagine grocery stores just want the long, straight, single stem carrot, and anything else that doesn't fit that, goodbye. And then the ugly bananas, is that just like bananas that have been bruised or is that also the same thing? Like if they're too short or too fat or something like that?
All of the above.
It's amazing what we've done to our food industry, isn't it? And I assume grocery stores are working off of hard data when they set these rules of like, well, people aren't going to buy it if it looks funny. But it also sometimes seems so arbitrary, like the specific size of banana. Like, do people really avoid? And maybe they do because they don't want to eat like a half of a tiny little banana, or they don't want, I don't know, an awkward carrot that's hard to like slice or something like that. I don't know. But it just seems so weird that we got to this place where anything that grows outside of one specific predetermined norm gets tossed.
It's interesting, right, that we judge our produce based on their imperfections.
Yeah. Yet we're in this kind of movement where we're all trying to be more mindful and self-care and appreciating our own imperfections, yet our food not allowed to be imperfect.
Exactly. We're supposed to be, yes, in a phase of embracing our flaws, but yet we want our produce to be immaculate.
Yeah. You did mention Outcast Foods, so I'll just mention that we have a episode on them back in the archives too. So you can also search Outcast Foods Evolve CPG and probably find that episode. And then you mentioned the upcycled coffee cherry, which I think is also called Cascara. Is that?
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Yeah. Because we had a coffee company on as well, Riff, which you can look in the archives for that too, if you want to dig into that. But they were basically making energy drinks out of the coffee cherries because of the same reason. They're just going to waste and actually becoming like an environmental pollution concern because coffee is consumed so much that there's a massive amount of these coffee cherries just being tossed and then leaching into the environment with anything in that quantity is bad. Not that they are bad themselves, but I figured they can make a beverage out of them because they have a natural sweetness, but then they also have, I think if I remember correctly, a little bit of caffeine still in them, or maybe he used green tea or some other kind of caffeine in there. But he made a energy drink out of the Cascara, which was pretty cool. I don't drink a lot of energy drinks, but I did like the taste of his because it just tasted a little more natural than a lot of those other energy drinks. They just taste like you're drinking a medicine cabinet or something.
Yes, I know what you're talking about. And Cascara does have some caffeine. It has caffeine that's about equivalent to dark chocolate. So it's not high like maybe even green tea or energy drink per se. So maybe he had it supplemented with something else. But it has a caffeine that's on par with dark chocolate.
That's awesome.
It's interesting though, in terms of not only are we throwing away food that leads to greenhouse gases and ultimately leads to climate change, but the food, these leftover rejected fruits and veggies, or the byproducts of sunflower oil, or even, you know, we see like upcycled ingredients that are leftover from like oat milk. It's that it's actually so nutritious. So we're just throwing away great nutritious ingredients. Like the coffee cherry has as much protein per gram as kale. And I already mentioned the sunflower protein flour, which is like 50% dense in terms of protein. So again, and the, you know, bananas and the carrots, like they're super nutritious. So we're just throwing away good food. Just because of their imperfections, we're throwing away food that could certainly nourish our bodies.
Yeah, we've done a handful of episodes on upcycling. And so there's great examples in the archive, but one that I talk about a lot is Dan from Regrained basically took the grain after all the sugars have been extracted essentially to make beer. So for people might then think, well, that grain is useless now. They even call it spent grain, right? Because it's spent, like the sugars have been extracted. But to your point, that doesn't mean there's still not all the protein and fiber and other kind of beneficial ingredients in those grains. So what Dan did was figure out another use for those grains to upcycle them into breads or flours or baking mixes or whatever else that you can kind of take those grains into. But there's so many examples of that too, like Pulp Pantry also was on the show, and she just takes the leftover pulp from juiceries that basically just throw out all that good nutrient stuff because they just want the sweet juice at the end, right? But she turns that into chips and probably other kind of snacks by now. I'm not sure. I haven't checked in on her in a little while. But your point is great in that not only are we wasting a bunch of resources to grow this food that then just gets tossed, but this is all just really good stuff that historically humans have used, right? That's what I like about things like upcycling and regenerative is it's actually just the way that we and everything else in nature have been operating since the beginning of time until more recently when we decided to become super industrial with our agriculture, our food manufacturing, and kind of stop doing those practices. But with upcycling, it's kind of just going back to the way that humans always were. When we had a lot of scrap of something left over when we're cooking, then we used it. Or if our bananas went a little brown, we turned it into banana bread or, you know, something like that. But we were typically always trying to use everything because resources are limited. We put a ton of effort into growing that food, right? So why would we just throw it out? But at an industrial scale, we just got so used to just throwing everything away because it was quote unquote more efficient that way. You don't have to figure out what to do with those other byproducts. But I'm excited that we're kind of recovering that kind of way of looking at all pieces of the food, the byproducts, and the core product we're trying to get out of it.
Completely agree with you.
Thanks for supporting that movement. So beyond allergen free and upcycled and plant-based / vegan, you're also women owned and a 1% for the planet member. So can you talk a little bit about what those both mean for people who might not know and how they might be helping you as a brand?
Sure. So we are a certified women owned. Let's see, just me as a founder, mompreneur one. And what does it mean to be women owned certified? So one for one, it was a lengthy process to get women owned certified. It's actually 20 some odd pages long, and even a recertification is that long. So it's not an easy feat. But what it means to be women-owned is that just historically, women have been at a disadvantage in terms of the workforce and in terms of being entrepreneurs. Less than 2% of VC funding goes to women-owned businesses. So it's really important to support women-owned businesses because of the disadvantage that many are at. And then in terms of 1% for the planet, yes, we are a proud member of 1% for the planet, meaning that we donate, and I don't like to say donate, we invest 1% of our sales in environmental causes and organizations. And not only that, we go a step further, in addition to investing 1% of our sales in environmental organizations, we actually volunteer monthly with an organization called Food Rescue US. And so what I do every month is I go to my local ShopRite and I fill up the car with all the food that they're about to throw away because the expiration date is pending. And then I drop it off to a local shelter for families in need. So fighting food waste and food insecurity.
Very cool. Yeah. I know that with 1% for the planet, you can do both cash donations, in-kind donations, and volunteer time. And then I think there's also like an option to do a little promotion of the nonprofits you're supporting as well, like where some of the resources you spend to promote those nonprofits can also be attributed or whatever put against your 1%. For Modern Species is also 1% for the planet, but the volunteer part, something we always forget to track or claim. Like we do lots of volunteering. It's just, we haven't gone through the process of checking to see if they're in the 1% database and then somehow like claiming those hours. But so most of our investment goes back through cash donations and then donating our services and time to groups like this year we've been working with Climate Collaborative, but we've worked with Upcycled Food Association as well as Fair World Project and a few others like that that we donate time to those nonprofits who are doing good things for the planet as well. So that's one of the things I love about 1% for the Planet is they make it, they set the bar relatively high, by which I mean people sometimes think it's 1% of profits, but it's not. It's 1% of revenue, which is, for depending on your margins, maybe 10, 20, 30x of profits, right? So of the percent of profits. So it's a decent amount, more than it sounds like. But then also a nuance there is you donate whether or not you even make a profit. So small startup businesses, right? If you base it on profit, then they could claim they donate 10% of profit. But if they never profit, then they're not donating anything. So 1% for the planet ties it to revenue. So you're just investing in the planet as kind of just as though you're investing in your company, right? Because the way I like hearing it argued is that we all rely on these resources that the planet provides. We can't operate our business without them. We can't live without them. So we're basically paying the planet tax, right, as part of operating the business. So I love that A, it's fairly substantial, but B, they give you options for how you can accomplish that 1%.
Couldn't agree with you more. And I think it's great what you're doing with Modern Species and 1% for the Planet. And I think, quite honestly, more organizations could do the same. And it's not a heavy lift to invest. You know, I think to your point, yes, it is not 1% of profits, it's 1% of sales. So it's a much greater number, but it's putting your money where your mouth is, right? And it's not just saying, hey, we're about sustainability. Same thing with upcycling. All our products are upcycled certified, right? It's not just saying, hey, we're upcycling, we're focused on sustainability, but actually, you know, there's a rigorous process to get certified for both 1% for the Planet and for Upcycled Food Association. So it's not greenwashing.
Right. So for any listeners out there, obviously you can support these movements. Like, you don't have to be 1% for the planet yourself, but you can be. You can be an individual member and do 1% of your salary, I think is what they do, which I think you can also do that through volunteering. But support products that have that 1% for the planet logo on them, then you're also supporting the planet, right? Because you're helping those businesses make their donations. But also, same thing with Upcycled Certified. If you see the Upcycled Certified logo on products, that's probably a good product to support if you want to fight against food waste, climate change, and all those other kind of things. And then, like you mentioned, Certified Women Owned is something that we've also featured a lot on the podcast, to your point, because, well, I can't remember the specific numbers, but the numbers of like women entrepreneurs out there is staggering. It's not like women don't start businesses and don't run businesses and don't lead businesses. They're out there, but they're just not getting the resources. And it's obviously a messed up system that's discriminating based on gender. Is also like, we also support minority owned kind of businesses on this show too, because of the same kind of thing. They're just not getting the same access to resources. So whenever you see listeners, when you see the Certified Women Owned logo on products, then go buy those products, because that means you're helping change the system. But one thing I wanted to ask you, Kimberly, is being part of Certified Women Owned, do they give you resources that help offset that and kind of level the playing field at all?
There's a few ways that they help. So one, they definitely help in terms of resources and webinars and coaches, networking events. It also does help in terms of supplier diversity programs. So certain retailers that you apply to are looking for diversity. And in order to apply for these opportunities, you must be either women-owned or minority-owned to apply for them. So it does help in terms of opening up new opportunities.
Very cool. Yeah, I can't remember which store it was right now, but I saw on LinkedIn recently that some grocery buyer had set up like a whole women-owned end cap at the grocery store, to where they had like 5 or 6 different women-owned brands featured there to kind of raise awareness about it. And I've seen some of the similar things for Upcycled and for Regenerative, I believe. So I love when grocery stores kind of join the movement and get involved and help raise awareness, like whether it's putting a little tag, like a shelf talker or a channel strip or something next to brands to help pull attention towards those brands, or by doing something like a unique display that kind of talks about some of the issues and features some of those products.
Yeah, I love that, because it's showing that the retail partner is truly partnering with these brands.
Right. Yeah. That's great. So you're doing a lot with your business, like the design of the products, you know, are better, healthier, avoid allergens, all that. But then with your business, you're also doing a lot to try to invest back into the planet or change the business landscape, which is amazing. not to add to the long list of things that you're doing, but I know when we first started talking a little bit more directly, it was around sustainable packaging. So can you talk a little bit about your journey trying to find the most sustainable package for your products as well?
Sure. Yes. When we spoke way back. So we launched the brand in May of 2023. And so I think we spoke just a little over a year ago in terms of finding the packaging. And I tend to be a very thorough shopper, let's call it, in terms of making sure that I have analyzed every single option out there. And so when selecting the packaging for the brand, obviously sustainability is core to the business. I wanted to make sure whatever packaging we use met that goal. And so I looked at compostable, I looked at paper, I looked at recycled plastics, or PCR, post-consumer recycled materials. And so where we landed actually was with post-consumer recycled materials. Compostable food pouches, so our baking mixes are in pouches, not boxes. In terms of the pouches that are available, compostable, unfortunately, at this date in 2024, only has a shelf life of 6 months. For food products. And so if your goal is to get into a Whole Foods, you need a longer shelf life than 6 months. So we couldn't go with compostable, although that was our ideal material. So then in terms of post-consumer resin or PCR, again, there's different levels of how much you can include in the pouch. And so there was anywhere from 10% to 43.5%, we found a supplier that had the 43.5%. So it was the highest level of PCR material in a food pouch. And so we ended up partnering with them, and that's what our baking mixes are packaged in.
Nice. Yeah, I think when we were chatting, I was kind of expressing some similar concerns. Like, we've had clients who've pushed real hard and worked 10 years to develop a compostable pouch, and we're in it for a while and still use it for some of their products. But I've also had other clients who went into compostable because that's fit their values, but didn't have as long of a testing period of 10 years or whatever to make sure it got right. So their products were kind of being tested as they got shipped, and they would have some manufacturers sit on the product, or warehouses or distributors or retailers sit with the product in their warehouse for too long. And then by the time it got on the shelf, the products were stale, and they would have to recall those products or something. So, and then we've also featured Humble Potato Chips recently, re-aired that episode, so it's right up at the top. But they've gone through an interesting journey on compostable too. And I was just checking in with her, Alicia from Humble, at the trade show and talking about compostable. And she said she ended up having to like back out of it for the time being too, because they were just having too many struggles and they're continuing to look for the right solution. So compostable in theory is a great idea, right? But right now, because of the nature of the ideas, the package goes away. Like, well, our food system has too many miles that things have to get shipped or sit on shelves or whatever before they're purchased. So when the package goes away too fast, that's not helpful. So I feel like we need different standards for compostable, by which I mean, in order for you to get certified compostable, it has to go away within a certain period of time under certain conditions, right? Which makes sense, because otherwise, if it takes 100 years to decompose, then is that really compostable? I mean, it's better than the thousands of years with plastic. But for food products, I think if we were able to certify to a different standard and just have a different process for them that allowed for more time and gave a couple of years of shelf life, but it'll still break down within a couple of years of being in a landfill or something, I think that could be a solution. But even then, like, you have to trust that people in all cities or states that you're shipping to have access to commercial compost or backyard composting, right? So there's just so many limitations.
That was the other issue when I was looking at the different packaging options. There was a stat that I found online, like 29% of Americans have access to composting.
Yeah.
So to create a packaging, again, with great efforts, but to then have a packaging that couldn't be, you know, what it was intended for in terms of composted than what was the purpose. And I know when we spoke a year ago, because actually it was the episode with Alicia that got me thinking about all these different options, and I connected with her after your episode with her, is we looked at recycled packaging. And I know I spoke with her about it, I spoke with you about it, in terms of recyclable package or pouches. And what I learned from both of you was that the machines cannot actually process the film from the pouches in the recycled machines. And so they would end up not getting recycled and again thrown away. So just like the compostable option, it was like, well, the intention is great, but then if the follow through doesn't happen, then is it really worth it?
Yeah, exactly. It's like every angle you go towards, there's some sort of barrier put up, right? But which is why I like where you landed, because I know a lot of people come to me asking for advice around like recyclable packaging, which I still think is, even though, you know, everyone's complaining that not everything you put in the recycling bin gets recycled, and we're having worldwide infrastructure issues since China kind of like closed their border to a lot of the recycling. And that's something that needs to be solved. But if it's a rigid container, it can be recycled fairly easily. We just need an economy that makes it financially profitable to recycle that material, right? The trick with, like you pointed out, the flexible plastics is that they sit flat like paper and they're hard to separate in the recycling process, right? So that's why often if something is listed as recyclable with flexible film, it's usually listed as store drop-off only, because it just needs to be collected and processed differently, which is a whole layer of consumer behavior and supply chain kind of stuff that's very unlikely, like you were pointing out. So it's only kind of like compostable is great in theory. Recyclable is great in theory. In practice, it's just not working out. So what I like right now is companies like yourself prioritizing post-consumer recycled content, because that boosts the recycling economy and, of course, offsets how much virgin plastic is required to make your products. So I think at the moment, that's where we need to be investing, is building up the economy of recycled plastics so we can build up the economy of recycling and get that machine moving again. And then we can look for all the flaws, the holes in the recycling system and patch those gaps. But nobody's ever going to patch those gaps if there's not money to be made, unfortunately. That's just the way the world works. So we need more companies sourcing recycled content like yourself. So I appreciate your kind of commitment there. I'm sure that journey was not easy. And as a sustainable packaging nerd, I feel you in the, you know, you want to do the right thing, but like the options are kind of limit themselves, right? Like if you get down to it, want something somewhat quote unquote sustainable today, you don't have that many options, unfortunately.
Unfortunately, not today. But I mean, we're heading in a good direction.
Yeah. I think every step people take and every attempt, even if it fails, is another step in the right direction for us figuring out what will work, right? All bad ideas or attempts are like fertilizer for rich soil for us to build the next level of innovation. So if nobody's taking a chance, if nobody's sticking their neck out and trying things, then we don't learn and we don't improve the system.
Absolutely.
Okay, so you're 2 to 3 years in the business now. I know you said you launched the products not 2 or 3 years ago, but you've been working on this, I think, for 2 or 3 years now. So what are some of the biggest and or most surprising lessons you've learned on the journey so far?
That's a great question. I would say the most surprising lesson is that there is no recipe for success. And so, you know, you can talk to and listen to all the podcasts, you know, How I Built This and all the great founders, and going into it, you think, okay, I'm going to mimic what they did, and this is going to be a wild overnight success. And it's not. It's so much test and learn. I like to say I'm planting a lot of seeds and seeing which ones will sprout. And so I think that's the biggest learning, is like, even though it may have worked for someone else, it may not work for you, and it may work for you, but it might not work for someone else. So there's no recipe to success, and there's certainly no overnight success.
Yeah. And maybe it's like there's no recipe, but maybe there's a process. Because, you know, if you look at food products, here's the recipe and then here's the directions, right? There may not be the right recipe, like 2 cups of this, 1 teaspoon of that. But to what you just pointed out, it's all about testing and learning, et cetera. I think all successful companies probably know that, right? while I don't always love to support Amazon, like their idea of like every day is day one, that's why they're successful probably, is because they don't take anything for granted. They always question everything. They always ask questions and try things, and they'll burn millions of dollars and years like coming up with an idea and just see if they want to launch it and then not launch it because they don't think it's going to work. Like they're just constantly investing in innovation, right? So I think all companies can learn to do more of that, which is another way of saying it is committed but not attached, by which was a phrase brought to me by a friend Manu, who explained it as you're committed to the outcomes but not attached to the path in which you get there, right? So you're committed to making Bake Me Healthy successful, but you're not attached to it having to be this SKU in this package form in this way, and it doesn't have to go down this path of these retailers or this e-com or whatever. You're committed to making it successful, and you're going to try lots of things and see what works and then follow the path that gets laid out in front of you and seems like the most feasible, and then still be willing to pivot, even if that's been working for a few years, because you never know, a pandemic or some other kind of thing is going to hit, or a new competitor pops up or something. So I think, because I've been running Modern Species for 15 years now, and I always thought like by year 10 or so that I would have it all figured out and it would just be like, perfect, I've got it dialed back. I can just go, you know, golf the rest of my life or something. But no, the world changes, the industry changes, the team changes, the clients change, the challenges change. So the only thing I've figured out is that you just have to constantly be willing to evolve and pivot, right? Every new thing that pops up, you've got to address it and move on to the next thing. And it's just that constant, like you said, planting lots of seeds, testing and learning. So if there is a quote unquote recipe for success, it's probably not the recipe, it's the process. The process of constantly learning and being willing to evolve. Nothing is precious. Everything can change. Well, the thing that I think should hold precious is like your purpose or your mission. Like, don't just go off and start making lawn care products as Bake Me Healthy or something, right? Like, stick to the core brand, but how you bring that to life can be anything.
Yes. And I think to your point, it's all about the learning, and it's all about the pivoting and just being flexible and resilient.
I like that. Flexible and resilient. So how can others support you on your mission?
For one, it would be great if folks wanted to support Bake Me Healthy by shopping our products on our website or on Amazon. So that's one. Two, I would say trying them out and giving us feedback. We're only in year one, so all feedback is good feedback. To the last point of testing, learning, optimizing, our recipes have changed, have been tweaked in the last year multiple times as we listen to consumers and get a better understanding of what they're looking for. I wanted to get the best product out on the market, my MVP, with the intent of let me get it out there so folks can try it, and then we can optimize it based on their feedback. So feedback is always great. And I mean, the last thing, you know, if you want to help a women-owned business with any tips, advice, resources, all welcome here.
Very cool. Yeah. So speaking of giving feedback and kind of evolving your recipes, I think that makes a ton of sense, right? But I'm curious, what are some of the biggest things you've found yourself needing to change? And part of the reason I ask is it could be the way people, how complicated they are to make. Because I just remember this case study. I can't remember which brand, but like some big legacy brand that found that their products weren't selling fast enough. So they, because they were like instant, just add water or something like that. And they found that if they made it slightly more complicated, but still easy, like that you had to add water and an egg or something like that, like literally just adding one more step made the sales go through the roof. Because while people wanted it to be easy, they also wanted to feel like they made it and that it wasn't some store-bought or like some just add water thing. So literally just one extra step of adding an egg made them feel like they were a baker. So when you've been evolving your products, has it been mostly on like flavor profile? Has it been on process? Has it been mostly on like packaging claims or whatever? Like, what have you had to evolve as you've gotten feedback?
Sure. So the case study was on Betty Crocker.
There you go.
So it was Betty Crocker where they discovered that if you added an egg, consumers felt like they were actually baking something in the kitchen. And so for me, it's been a couple of things. Flavor profile in our banana bread and carrot cake, dialing up the banana and carrot flavors a little bit. In our brownies, probably the biggest learning was when we launched our brownie mix, I wanted, all our products and ingredients are clean ingredients, but I'm super purist on one end, super health nut. And so I use dark chocolate, 100% dark chocolate chips in our fudgy brownie mix, because I didn't want any of those fillers or palm oil or like artificial sweeteners. And so when we launched, I got feedback that it was too bitter, which if anyone has ever had 100% dark chocolate chip or dark chocolate or even 80 or 90% dark chocolate, you know how bitter that can be. And so when we got that feedback, I then looked for other less bitter chocolate chips, still maintaining the dark chocolate. And so I found, and we partner with a brand to get this dark chocolate. And so I found it at 70% dark chocolate, but not filled with any other fillers, just some, you know, other sweeteners, a touch of sweetener. So again, that was really listening to what consumers were saying as far as like flavor and sweetness and taste.
Yeah, that's interesting too that you bring that up, because like dialing up carrot or whatever, yeah, that makes sense because you're buying, you know, a carrot cake or whatever it is and you want it to taste like that. But then the having to drop the dark chocolate kind of flavor to be less bitter, that's where me maybe as an entrepreneur, like committed to the way I want to change the world, would always like be like, oh, but do I do it? I know that's what consumers want, but I wanted to make something that changes consumers, not necessarily just ends up devolving into like a sugary treat like I was trying to eliminate. Obviously, going from 100% to 70% is not turning into a sugary treat. Right. But I imagine if I were creating my own baking line of products, it's those decisions where I would like be questioning how strong to hold to my values, kind of, you know, maybe it's back to the committed but not attached, right? It's like, which things am I attached to that I need to let go of, or which things, where do I like hold strong and not make that change? Because I've even talked to like organic companies, for example, where the price of organic ingredients is through the roof and they're considering dropping to non-GMO, but organic is the whole reason they started their company in the first place. And do they drop that or do they lose sales because their price is going to have to go up? And at some point you have to like check back in on, well, why was I doing organic, or why was I doing 100% dark chocolate in the first place? And kind of talk to yourself about what changes are okay to make and what changes are just kind of a slippery slope back into giving the market what you were trying to avoid in the first place. So I'm curious with that dark chocolate one, was that a really tough decision for you, or was it just so long as you could find something without fillers, you were fine?
It was definitely a tough decision. And I like to say with our baking mixes, you don't have to compromise. And then I felt like as I was developing the products or evolving the products, I was like, oh gosh, I have to compromise on this. I can't launch compostable packaging. I'm compromising on the packaging. I have to change the dark chocolate to something that has a little bit of sweetener in it. So that one, I for sure was a tough decision for me to make. But ultimately, what I have learned actually from all of this, and probably one of the biggest surprises, is taste, right? Consumers want to deliver on taste first and foremost. They want something that's delicious. They don't want something that may taste gluten-free or taste vegan, or to like have, you know, a misconception of what it maybe tastes like cardboard because it's healthy. They deserve to get something that's delicious. And so making sure that I continue to involve listening to the feedback on delivering an exceptional product that delivers first and foremost on taste. And I think that was actually one of the biggest surprises coming into food from beauty. Beauty, you know, we could develop these beautiful formulas that were efficacious, but taste is so subjective. Like I could give you this dark chocolate chip fudgy brownie and you could love it. And you could have, I don't know, your cousin try it and she may hate it. So that's been the most fascinating thing, is just how subjective taste is to consumers.
Yeah, that's got to be really difficult because, I mean, at the end of the day, then you're just looking at data and maybe it's like 54% of people think it should be less bitter and the other 46% think it's fine. And then you have to be like, well, do I go with the slight majority there, or do I stick to my guns and keep it on the bitter side or something? And I don't know, there's probably some tough decisions to make unless it's like literally like 90% said they want this and 10% said they want that, right? But like when it's kind of in the middle, it's tough to make those decisions. And I guess at the end of the day, it goes back to your goals. Like, is the goal to make the product that a handful of really hardcore consumers really want because they're not going to make literally any compromises, they don't take any sugar, you know, like whatever it is that they're sticking to? Or is it more of a progress over perfection kind of mindset where you just want something better than what's on the market, even if it's not perfect, because people really don't want perfect in terms of health or nutrition, right? They want taste first and then health and nutrition second. So I think if you want to grow the company, then yeah, you've got to be willing to flex a bit on some of those more hardcore health goals.
Right. And it's listening more to the consumers versus your own personal perspective. So even though I was like, oh, it tastes fine, it's super healthy and clean, listening to the other folks who were like, oh, it's too dark, it's too bitter. So yeah, you do have to flex definitely in that respect.
Yeah. And I think that's an area where I would probably struggle to have a food business too, is because I know my tastes are not the mainstream, by which I mean almost every processed treat kind of on the market is way too sweet for me. Like I, even though everyone's all obsessed over the new wave of sodas like Olipop, et cetera, I still can't drink any of them because they're just too sweet. Like I like something like Nixie, for example, which is very lightly flavored, unsweet, or like no sugar added kind of stuff, just like a little bit of juice flavor or something like that. But like, I know I'm not the normal consumer. So if I was developing the products, I would make them all like something I like, but I know most people don't eat the way I eat. So that's got to be difficult. So then you just got to rely on the research, I guess.
Let the numbers and the data show you where to go.
Right. It seems like you're making really good progress as I continue to follow your journey. Seems like you're building brick by brick and it's all the pieces are coming together. I know as an entrepreneur, it can feel like a long road yet ahead still. So I just like to check back and say, okay, well, I may not be where I want to be yet or where my ultimate goal is, but I've come so far and I can keep going, right? So I'm really enjoying your journey and I'm picturing you going far with it too, because I can see you just being committed to the continuous evolution of figuring it out. So congrats on all your progress and success so far. And I can't wait to continue watching the journey.
Thank you so much, Gage. Yes, it's certainly been a journey. And you know, I tend to have to remind myself to look at the rainbow and enjoy the journey. You know, so it's definitely the path less taken. It's harder than it looks, which is why many people don't do it. But it's certainly, it's a rewarding journey because it's something that you're building of your own. It is, every brick is your own. You're building that by yourself and with the help of others, with the village, of course. But it's something that you have a vision for and that you're going to play. And then hopefully I'll see and hopefully we'll be able to deliver upon the Bake Me Healthy vision and delivering healthy, allergy-friendly, sustainable baking to all houses across the U.S. and beyond.
Yeah, I love it and I'm excited to continue watching it. And now I'd like to shift into a fun rapid round question segment wrap up. So you can answer these super briefly or with a little more detail, but the idea is just to get to know you a little bit better. So besides your brand, what is your favorite baking mix or baked goods brand?
I would have to say my favorite baked, actually they're both a baking mix / baked goods brand, which is Nowhere Bakery.
Nowhere, okay.
Nowhere Bakery in California. They make delicious cookies. You know, the founder met him at actually Summer Fancy Food Show. They were recently on Shark Tank. So Nowhere Bakery is definitely my favorite.
Very cool. I'll have to check them out. I haven't heard of them yet. Okay. If you could do a collab with any brand, who would it be?
If we were to collaborate with a brand, it would probably be Just Eat. They are women-owned. They're also another upcycled brand, and they have a natural sweetener using dates. So I think that would be a natural fit, pun intended.
And you said it was Just Date?
Correct. Just Date. Yeah, they make date syrups and date sugar.
Yeah, that seems pretty aligned. Good idea. I like it. What's the best piece of advice you've received recently or maybe ever, if you want to go back into the advice archives?
So recently, I actually met with this career coach. Her name is Jean Tien, and we just met through another mutual founder. And she gave me this good analogy as I'm planting all these seeds. She said, you know, I was talking to her about focus and prioritizing, and especially as a founder entrepreneur, we wear all the hats, and how do you figure out which hat you're supposed to wear at any given moment? And she gave me this good analogy of the stove, which was great for me being in the kitchen. And so she said, you have your back burners and you have your front burners. And your front burners are everything that you need to watch carefully because they're the main feature of your meal. And then on the back burner is things that are simmering, right? And stuff that can take like that back burner. And so figuring out what goes on your front burner and what goes on your back burner. And so that has helped me to really focus and prioritize on what needs to be done today versus what can wait until next month.
That's cool. I like that framework. I might steal it.
Go for it.
Cool. So who's an impact-driven leader you admire and why?
An impact-driven leader that I admire is Pallavi Pandey from Detox. I think she was on your podcast before.
She was, yes.
Yes. I can't remember how I met Pallavi, but I love what she's doing at Detox and creating sustainable dinnerware using palm leaves. And I think she's really like crushing it in terms of championing sustainability. So I think there's a lot to learn from her.
Yes. Just like all the other episode shout outs I've been giving, you can, I don't know the episode number, but you can search for Pallavi or Detox, DTOCS, in the Evolve CPG or Brands for a Better World archive. Yeah, she's got a great story too. And it's just another one of those things that makes sense. Like there's these resources that just naturally occur and fall off of trees, and they make great alternative plates and bowls. And I think she was also maybe working on straws at one point. I'm not sure if that continued, but why not use those natural resources instead of plastic or other things that are never going to go away? And what I really liked about her stuff is that it's really sturdy and reusable rather than just a one use too. So that's, she's doing great stuff. Since this podcast is called Brands for a Better World, what does a better world mean to you?
So let's say, so better world to me means a couple things, right? It's being able to treat yourself without having to compromise. So be people who are able to enjoy sweets and treats regardless of their dietary restrictions. And then it's also a better world is being kinder to planet Earth. It's our home. We need to take care of it. I love the the reference you made in terms of paying the tax. So we're only renting this. we're only tenants of this planet. And so just being kind to our Earth, because the resources are not limitless. So how do we make the most of it, and how do we give back and make sure that this is a better world for future generations?
Right. I love it. Take care of ourselves and the planet so that other generations can take care of themselves. Because if we don't take care of the planet, like you were saying, then how are future generations going to treat themselves without compromise?
Absolutely. And that's what I teach my kids almost every day, is like, we need to be good citizens of the Earth.
Yeah, I love it. Well, again, thanks for doing everything you're doing to bring better food to the market, but also to build a better kind of business and kind of demonstrate what true impact leadership looks like. I appreciate everything you're doing. And again, can't wait to watch where you go from here.
Thank you so much, Gage. It's been so fun talking about sustainability and allergy friendliness and just building this better world that we live in.
Love it. Okay. Cheers. If you like this show, remember to help us grow by liking, reviewing, and sharing. If you're new here, don't forget we have over 100 episodes in the archive. Some might be called Evolve CPG, but it's the same show, so dig in for more goodness. If you consider yourself an impact-driven professional, join me over at impactdriven.community, where we're supporting each other's growth as impact leaders. Thanks for listening. To learn more about Kimberly or Bake Me Healthy, visit bakemehealthy.co.